Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Up first today is a story from the personal history section of the October 25th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Writing Eleanor Rigby by Paul McCartney. My mom's favorite cold cream was Nivea, and I love it to this day. That's the cold cream I was thinking of in the description of the face Eleanor keeps in a jar by the door. I was always a little scared by how often women used cold cream. Growing up, I knew a lot of old ladies, partly through what was called Baba Job Week, when scouts did chores for a shilling. You'd get a shilling for cleaning out a shed or mowing a lawn. I wanted to write a song that would sum them up. Eleanor Rigby is based on an old lady that I got on with very well. I don't even know how I first met Eleanor Rigby, but I would go around to her house, and not just once or twice. I found out that she lived on her own, so I would go around there and just chat, which is sort of crazy if you think about me being some young Liverpool guy. Later, I would offer to go and get her shopping. She'd give me a list, and I'd bring the stuff back, and we'd sit in her kitchen. I still vividly remember the kitchen because she had a little crystal radio set. That's not a brand name. It actually had a crystal inside it. Crystal radios were quite popular in the 1920s and 30s. So I would visit, and just hearing her stories enriched my soul and influenced the songs I would later write. Eleanor Rigby may actually have started with a quite different name. Daisy Hawkins, was it? I can see that Hawkins is quite nice, but it wasn't right. Jack Hawkins had played Quintus Arius in Ben-Hur. Then there was Jim Hawkins from one of my favorite books, Treasure Island. But it wasn't right. This is the trouble with history, though. Even if you were there, which I obviously was, it's sometimes very difficult to pin down. It's like the story of the name Eleanor Rigby on a marker in the graveyard at St. Peter's Church in Woolton, which John and I certainly wandered around, endlessly talking about our future. I don't remember seeing the grave there, but I suppose I might have registered it subliminally. St. Peter's Church also plays quite a big part in how I come to be talking about many of these memories today. Back in the summer of 1957, Ivan Vaughn, a friend from school, and I went to the Woolton Village Fete at the church together, and he introduced me to his friend John, who was playing there with his band, The Quarrymen. I'd just turned 15 at this point, and John was 16, and Ivan knew we were both obsessed with rock and roll, so he took me over to introduce us. One thing led to another. Typical teenage boys posturing and the like, and I ended up showing off a little by playing Eddie Cochran's 20 Flight Rock on the guitar. I think I played Gene Vincent's Bebop-a-Lula and a few Little Richard's songs, too. A week or so later, I was out on my bike and bumped into Pete Shotton, who was the Quarrymen's washboard player, a very important instrument in a skiffle band. He and I got talking, and he told me that John thought I should join them. That was a very John thing to do, have someone else ask me so he wouldn't lose face if I said no. John often had his guard up, but that was one of the great balances between us. He could be quite caustic and witty, but once you got to know him, he had this lovely, warm character. I was more the opposite, pretty easygoing and friendly, but I could be tough when needed. I said I would think about it, and a week later said yes. And after that, John and I started hanging out quite a bit. I was on school holidays, and John was about to start art college, usefully next door to my school. I showed him how to tune his guitar. He was using banjo tuning. I think his neighbor had done that for him before, and we taught ourselves how to play songs by people like Chuck Berry. I would have played him I Lost My Little Girl a while later when I'd got my courage up to share it, and he started showing me his songs, and that's where it all began. I do this tour when I'm back in Liverpool with friends and family. I drive around the old sites, pointing out places like our old house on Forthlith Road, and I sometimes drive by St. Peter's, too. It's only a short drive by car from the old house, and I do often stop and wonder about the chances of the Beatles getting together. We were four guys who lived in this city in the north of England, but we didn't know one another. Then, by chance, we did get to know one another, and then we sounded pretty good when we played together, and we all had that youthful drive to get good at this music thing. To this very day, it still is a complete mystery to me that it happened at all. Would John and I have met some other way if Ivan and I hadn't gone to that fifth? I'd actually gone along to try and pick up a girl. I'd seen John around, in the chip shop, on the bus, that sort of thing, and thought he looked quite cool, but would we have ever talked? I don't know. As it happened, though, I had a school friend who knew John. And then I also happened to share a bus journey with George to school. All these small coincidences had to happen to make the Beatles happen, and it does feel like some kind of magic. It's one of the wonderful lessons about saying yes when life presents these opportunities to you. You never know where they might lead. And, as if all these coincidences weren't enough, it turns out that someone else who was at the fete had a portable tape machine, one of those old Grundigs. So there's this recording, admittedly a pretty bad quality, of the Quarrymen's performance that day. You can listen to it online. And there are also a few photos around of the band on the back of a truck. So this day, that proved to be pretty pivotal in my life, still has this presence and exists in these ghosts of the past. I always think of things like these as being happy accidents. Like when someone played the tape machine backward in Abbey Road, and the four of us stopped in our tracks and went, "Oh, what's that?" So then we'd use that effect in a song, like on the backward guitar solo for "I'm Only Sleeping." It happened more recently, too, on the song "Caesar Rock" from my album Egypt Station. Somehow this drum part got dragged accidentally to the start of the song on the computer, and we played it back, and it's just there in those first few seconds, and it doesn't fit, but at the same time it does. So my life is full of these happy accidents, and coming back to where the name Eleanor Rigby comes from, my memory has me visiting Bristol, where Jane Asher was playing at the Old Vic. I was wandering around, waiting for the play to finish, and saw a shop sign that read Rigby, and I thought, that's it! It really was as happenstance as that. When I got back to London, I wrote the song in Mrs. Asher's music room in the basement of 57 Wimpole Street, where I was living at the time. Around that same time, I'd started taking piano lessons again. I took lessons as a kid, but it was mostly just practicing scales, and it seemed more like homework. I loved music, but I hated the homework that came along with learning it. I think in total, I gave piano lessons 3 attempts. The first time when I was a kid, and my parents sent me to someone they knew locally. Then, when I was 16, I thought, maybe it's time to try and learn to play properly. I was writing my own songs by that point and getting more serious about music, but it was still the same scales. Ah! Get out of here! And when I was in my early 20s, Jane's mom, Margaret, organized lessons for me with someone from the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, where she worked. I even played Eleanor Rigby on piano for the teacher, but this was before I had the words. At the time, I was just blocking out the lyrics and singing Ola non tungi over vamped E minor chords. I don't remember the teacher being all that impressed. The teacher just wanted to hear me play even more scales, so that put an end to the lessons. When I started working on the words in earnest, Eleanor was always part of the equation, I think, because we had worked with Eleanor Braun on the film Help, and we knew her from the establishment Peter Cook's Club on Greek Street. I think John may have dated her for a short while, too, and I liked the name very much. Initially, the priest was Father McCartney, because it had the right number of syllables. I took the song to John at around that point, and I remember playing it to him, and he said, "That's great, Father McCartney." He loved it. But I wasn't really comfortable with it because it's my dad, my Father McCartney. So I literally got out the phone book and went on from McCartney to McKenzie. The song itself was consciously written to evoke the subject of loneliness, with the hope that we could get listeners to empathize. Those opening lines, "Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where our wedding has been, lives in a dream." It's a little strange to be picking up rice after a wedding. Does that mean she was a cleaner, someone not invited to the wedding and only viewing the celebrations from afar? Why would she be doing that? I wanted to make it more poignant than her just cleaning up afterward, so it became more about someone who was lonely, someone not likely to have her own wedding, but only the dream of one. Allen Ginsberg told me it was a great poem, so I'm going to go with Allen. He was no slouch. Another earlier admirer of the song was William S. Burroughs, who, of course, also ended up on the cover of Sgt. Pepper. He and I had met through the author Barry Miles and the Indica Bookshop, and he actually got to see the song take shape when I sometimes used the spoken word studio that we had set up in the basement of Ringo's flat in Montague Square. The plan for the studio was to record poets, something we did more formally a few years later with the experimental Zapple label, a subsidiary of Apple. I'd been experimenting with tape loops a lot around this time, using a Breneal reel-to-reel, which I still own, and we were starting to put more experimental elements into our songs. Eleanor Rigby ended up on the Revolver album, and for the first time, we were recording songs that couldn't be replicated on stage. Songs like this and Tomorrow Never Knows. So Burroughs and I had hung out, and he'd borrowed my reel-to-reel a few times to work on his cut-ups. When he got to hear the final version of Eleanor Rigby, he said he was impressed by how much narrative I'd got into three verses. And it did feel like a breakthrough for me lyrically. More of a serious song. George Martin had introduced me to the string quartet idea through Yesterday. I'd resisted the idea at first, but when it worked, I fell in love with it. So I ended up writing Eleanor Rigby with a string component in mind. When I took the song to George, I said that for the accompaniment, I wanted a series of E minor chord stabs. In fact, the whole song is really only two chords, C major and E minor. In George's version of things, he conflates my idea of the stabs and his own inspiration by Bernard Herrmann, who had written the music for the movie Psycho. George wanted to bring some of that drama into the arrangement. And, of course, there's some kind of madcap connection between Eleanor Rigby, an elderly woman left high and dry, and the mummified mother in Psycho. And now, from the fiction section of the October 25th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Umbrella, by Tove Ditlevsen. Helga had always, unreasonably, expected more from life than it could deliver. People like her live among us, not differing conspicuously from those who instinctively settle their affairs and figure out precisely how, given their looks, their abilities, and their environment, they can do what they need to do in the world. With respect to these three factors, Helga was only averagely equipped. When she was put on the marriage market, she was slightly too small and slightly too drab, with narrow lips, a turned-up nose, and her only promising feature, a pair of large, questioning eyes, which an attentive observer might have called dreamy, but Helga would have been embarrassed if anyone had asked her what she was dreaming about. She had never demonstrated a special talent of any kind. She had done adequately in public school and had shown good longevity at her domestic jobs. She didn't mind working hard. In her family, that was as natural as breathing. For the most part, she was accommodating and quiet, without being withdrawn. In the evenings, she went out to dance halls with a couple of girlfriends. They each had a soda and looked for partners. If they had sat for a long time without an offer, her girlfriends grew eager to dance with anyone who asked, even a man with a hunchback. But Helga just stared absent-mindedly around the venue, and if she saw a man who appealed to her, those who did always had dark hair and brown eyes, she gazed at him so steadily, unguarded and serious, that he could not help but notice her. If someone other than her chosen one approached her, and this actually didn't happen very often, she looked down at her lap, blushed slightly, and awkwardly excused herself. "I don't dance." A few tables away, a pair of brown eyes would observe this unusual sight. Here was a girl who wasn't going to fall for the first man who came along. Over time, many small infatuations rippled the surface of her mind, like the spring breeze that makes new leaves tremble without changing their life's course. The man would follow her home and kiss a pair of cold, closed lips which refused to open in any kind of submission. Helga was very conventional. It wasn't that she wouldn't surrender before marriage, but she had it in her head that she would have a ring on and would present the chosen man to her parents before it came to that. The ones who were too impatient or not interested enough to wait for this ceremony went away more or less disappointed. Sometimes she felt a little pang at these moments, but she soon forgot about it in her life's rhythm of work, sleep, and new evenings with new possibilities. That was until, at the age of 23, she met Egan. He fell in love with her singularity, that indefinable quality which only a few people noticed and even fewer judged an asset. Egan was a mechanic and was interested in soccer, playing the numbers, pool, and girls. But since every love-struck individual is brushed by winged beats from a higher level of the atmosphere, it so happened that this commonplace person started reading poetry and expressing himself in ways that would have made his buddies at the shop gape in wonder if they had heard him. Later, he looked back on this time as if he had caught a severe illness, which left its mark on him for the rest of his life. But for as long as it lasted, he was proud of and delighted by Helga's carefully preserved chastity, and when they had put on rings and the presentation to her family was over, he took ownership of his property on the prepared sofa in his rented room. Everything was how it was supposed to be. She hadn't tricked him. Satisfied, he fell asleep, leaving Helga in a rather confused state. She cried a bit, because here, in particular, she had been expecting something extraordinary. Her tears were pointless, since her path had now been determined. The wedding date had been set, supplies had been gathered, and she had given notice at her job, because Egan wouldn't have her scrubbing other people's floors after they were married. Her friends were appropriately jealous, and her parents were content. Egan was a skilled laborer and therefore slightly higher up in the world than her father, who had taught her never to lower herself, but not to cook up fantasies either. That evening, Helga had no clear premonition that something fateful was happening to her. Even so, she lay awake for a long time without thinking of anything in particular. When she was half asleep, a strange desire came drifting into her consciousness. "If only I had an umbrella," she thought. It occurred to her suddenly that this item, which for certain people was just a natural necessity, was something she had dreamed of her entire life. As a child, she had filled her Christmas wish list with sensible, affordable things. A doll, a pair of red mittens, roller skates, and then, when the gifts were lying under the tree on Christmas Eve, she'd been gripped by an ecstasy of expectation. She'd looked at her boxes as though they had held the meaning of life itself, and her hands had shaken as she opened them. Afterward, she sat crying over the doll, the mittens, and the roller skates she had asked for. "You ungrateful child," her mother had hissed. "You always ruin it for us." Which was true, because the next Christmas the scene would repeat itself. Helga never knew what she was expecting to find inside those festive-looking packages. Maybe she had once written umbrella on her wish list and not received one. It would have been ridiculous to give her such a trivial and superfluous thing. Her mother had never owned an umbrella. You took the wind and the weather as it came, without imagining that you could indulgently protect your precious hair and skin from the rain, which spared nothing else. Helga eventually turned her attention to her role as a fiancé and, together with her mother, carried out the customary duties. Yet sometimes she would lie awake next to Egan or in her bed in the maid's room in the house where she worked, nursing her peculiar dream of owning an umbrella. A certain image started to form in her mind, which gave her secret desire a forbidden and irresponsible tinge and cast a delicate, impalpable veil over her expression throughout the day, causing her fiancé to exclaim, with jealousy and irritation, as if he had suspected her of some kind of infidelity, "What are you thinking about?" Once she answered, "I'm thinking about an umbrella." And with convincing seriousness, he said, "You're crazy." By then, he had stopped reading poetry, and he never mentioned her dreamy eyes anymore, which didn't mean that he was disappointed in any way. It was just now that she was a permanent part of his life and his routine. She sat through countless soccer matches with him, without ever grasping what it was about this particular form of entertainment that made people shout hooray or fall silent as if possessed. The image that arose from her memory was this. She was about 10, sitting in the window of the family bedroom, looking down into the courtyard, which was illuminated with a weak glow by the light over the back stairs. She was in her nightgown, and should have been in bed, but she had developed the habit, before going to sleep, of sitting there for a few minutes and staring out into the night without thinking about anything, while a gentle peace erased the events of the day from her mind. All at once, she saw the gate open, and across the wet cobblestones of the courtyard, onto which raindrops splashed in an excited rhythm, strolled a pretty, dreamlike creature. Her long yellow dress nearly touched the ground, and high above her profusion of silky blonde curls floated an umbrella. It was not like the one Helga's grandmother used, round, black, and dome-shaped with a solid handle, but a flat, bright, translucent thing which seemed to compliment the person who carried it like a butterfly's radiant wings. She had just a brief glimpse, and then the courtyard was deserted as before. But Helga's heart was pounding with strange excitement. She ran into the living room, where her mother and father were sitting. A lady was walking across the courtyard, she said softly. And then she added with awe and admiration, "She had such a nice umbrella." She stood there barefoot, blinking into the light. The familiar room, which lacked anything with the comparable essence, now seemed to her cramped and poor. Her mother looked surprised. "A lady?" she asked. Then the corners of her mouth turned downward, as they often did when something displeased or bothered her. "It's that girl next door," she said sharply. "It's scandalous." Then Helga's father turned to her with a flash of anger. "Why the devil are you sitting staring out the window when you should be in bed?" he yelled. "Get in there and go to sleep." She had seen something that she wasn't allowed to see. Something had been let into her world that wasn't there before. After that, every evening, even though she was an obedient child, she crept over to the window to watch the yellow dress drift across the cobblestones in all kinds of weather, but always with an inexpressibly sweet and secretive air, and always accompanied by that mysterious umbrella, visible or invisible, depending on if it was raining or not. This vision had nothing to do with the sleepy face that appeared in the neighbor's door frame when Helga knocked to borrow a bit of margarine or flour for her mother, who was always short on the most important ingredients when she was making gravy. And it made no noticeable difference when one day this neighbor moved away. For a long time, the child still waited at the window for that yellow dress and the buoyant, translucent umbrella. When this nightly passage through the darkening courtyard stopped, she just shut her eyes and listened to the rain splashing against something taut and silky and more distant than all her childhood sounds and smells. Helga and Egan moved into a two-room apartment that was similar to her parents' and wasn't far away either. But it was at street level, and an old wish of Helga's was fulfilled. Now that she could sit in her own house and look out at the traffic, she had what she'd never had before, time. And, since idleness is the root of all evil, she was easy prey for sayings like that. This gave her a slightly guilty conscience. Not toward the husband who provided for her, but just in general. She allowed herself to become a gentle, self-effacing individual. She exaggerated the few responsibilities she had and emphasized her frequent visits to her parents and their visits to her. Her in-laws lived in the country, and she wrote to them often, though she had met them only at the wedding. Her letters, which contained detailed accounts of how she spent her day doing domestic duties and got the most out of Egan's salary for everyone's benefit, always ended monotonously with these lines: "We are both well and hope the same for you. Your devoted daughter-in-law, Helga." Every morning, she and her mother went shopping, each with a headscarf and a sturdy shopping bag. Her mother shopped for the best cuts of meat at the butcher. Men who worked hard need a solid meal, she explained. Helga served a solid meal for her husband at precisely 6 o'clock every evening. But from the moment he left in the morning until that hour, she rarely thought of him. When the shopping and the cleaning were done, she sat at the window with some darning that was meant to distract her from the fact that she was sitting there idly, while the people in the street all seemed to have so much to do. From her protected, hidden spot behind the curtain, she observed them with interest and seriousness, the way she had, before Egan, observed all men with brown eyes. She was filled with vague curiosity. Where were they going? Why were they so busy? Although she didn't realize it, she was lonely. She often thought about her mother because, in Helga's eyes, her mother was a person who, unlike everyone else, never changed. It was kind of a respite for Helga to be with her mother. Mother and child, comfort. She loved recalling her childhood. She liked hearing her mother talk about things that had happened. Her mother talked a lot. The sentences strained from her, forming sturdy frames around distant, blurry landscapes. Often she said, "You are doing so well. You should appreciate it more. But you have always been ungrateful." "Ungrateful how?" Helga asked. Then every time she got the story about all the tears she had shed when she received gifts, "In the end, we were simply afraid to buy you anything," her mother said. And there, in the twilight, they sat, shaking their heads at the thought of this unappreciative child who had cried over gifts that would have delighted other children. They talked about this mystery in the same tone one might use to talk about getting over scarlet fever. "Good heavens, you were so sick, we thought you might never get over it." Most of all, Helga loved hearing about everything that was outside the parameters of her own memory. About the first words she'd spoken, when she'd been toilet trained, and so on. Things that did not differentiate her at all from any other child a mother might talk about. Her mother liked to end these stories while getting up and gathering her belongings by making some remark like, "Well, we won't be seeing those times again." Generalization spoken without the slightest tone of complaint, but that left a small rip in the veil that lay over Helga's innermost being, like the membrane around an unborn child. When her mother left, always soon before Egan was expected home, Helga waved to her familiar substantial figure for as long as she could see it, and then she sat down at the window without turning on the light. A sadness grew within her and around her. She thought, if only Egan could come home. But when he did come home and filled the small rooms with his noisy company, every enchantment was shattered. Could it be that it wasn't him she was longing for? She walked around quietly, carrying out her housewifely duties, picked at her food like a bird, and said yes and no when her husband's remarks required an answer. Once he regarded her closely. "You should have a kid," he said. "I damn well don't understand why it's not happening." Then she blushed, partly at her deficiency in that department, but more because she didn't actually mind not having a child. Her togetherness with her mother allowed the child Helga to live on within her, and it was as if there weren't room for another one. Sometimes she lied to Egan when he asked if her mother had been over, because for some reason he didn't like her mother to visit so often when he wasn't home. The days passed without much to distinguish one from the next. One evening, Helga had the food waiting for an hour before Egan came home, and when he did arrive, he was drunk. He threw himself down on the sofa, from which he had followed her movements through the living room with a furtive, sinister glare. "What's wrong with you?" he asked suddenly. "Your face looks all pasty." She was shocked and quickly put some rouge on her cheeks, but later she got used to his tone. She also got used to making food that was easily reheated, because it became impossible to predict when he would come home. She told her mother, "Egan started drinking." Her mother seemed to be more uneasy about it than Helga was. "When a man drinks, it's because he's dissatisfied with his wife," she declared. And since she was of the opinion that you could always do something about a problem, she advised her daughter to talk it out with Egan and figure out what was the matter. But Helga had never tried to put herself in another person's shoes. It had never been necessary. Her entire character consisted of a pile of memories without a pattern or a plan. There were a number of pairs of brown eyes, a twilight mood, an immense undefined expectation, a yellow dress, and an umbrella. There were tears and disappointments and so many other things, and small joys in between. And there was a man who had opened her narrow, pale lips and for a few moments made her feel the tug of something unknown and wonderful. There was a voice that had said strange and sweet words to her, and over it all stretched the fine silk umbrella canopy of her childhood and her dreams. This had nothing to do with the man who had started drinking. She thought she had given him as much of herself as he could reasonably expect, and her vague feeling of inadequacy with him was only because she wasn't pregnant, as a newly married wife ought to be. But it seemed to her that, as usual, she expected something more for herself, a kind of surfeit that went only to other unknown individuals. Not that she blamed anyone for anything. She had never done that because she knew how unreasonable she was. She had written things on her life's wish list that were achievable: time to dream, a husband with brown eyes, and a child, the last one for conventional reasons. Her outward behavior had always been dictated by tangible things, so she assumed that it was something concrete that had made Egan start drinking and speaking harshly to her. She nodded thoughtfully to her mother over her tea and promised to talk it out with her husband. But she had already decided that it was the lack of a child that was bothering him, and matters no one could do anything about were not proper topics of conversation, not even with her mother. That evening, Egan came home at midnight. He threw his dirty overalls in the middle of the living room and called for Helga, who was warming up the food.
"I'm fed up to hear with it," he said slowly, swaying on his legs like a sailor.
She appeared in the kitchen door, staring at him with her sorrowful, wondering eyes. "What are you fed up with?" she asked anxiously.
"Everything," he said, his alcohol breath reeking in her face. "What do you think I am, an idiot?"
She didn't answer, but pulled back from him a step. Her mind was slow, never fully able to follow a situation, especially a surprising one. Her mind quickened only with memories.
The food is burning, she said hesitantly.
He laughed callously.
I don't want any food, he drawled. I ate already.
Where did you eat? She asked quietly, starting to untie her apron. Her hands trembled slightly. He could see that she was hurt or afraid, and he laughed loudly again.
With a good-looking girl, if you absolutely must know, he shouted triumphantly.
Then he belched in her face, walked into the bedroom, and lay down on the bed, fully dressed. Helga followed him. She looked at him, confused, numb to any clear thought or feeling, as she fumbled for a safe, childlike footing. She whispered, I'm going to tell my mother. But he was already asleep. Actually, she didn't feel any more hurt by the thought that he could have very likely cheated on her than she knew a person ought to feel. A husband shouldn't drink, but if he cheats, that is much worse. Instead of having her usual fantasies, she imagined him with another woman. But it didn't really make much difference. It was only her outer life that he was threatening. It didn't change who she was. Her body was the same as before, with one small distinction. It had lessened in value to other men. The term other men hadn't occurred to her since she'd got married. Now, as she slowly undressed, she thought only about that because she knew that her mother would. Her mother would rationalize that if this husband neglected his obligations, then she would have to turn to other brown-eyed men for the pursuit of her daily bread. This idea that the men absolutely had to have brown eyes came, by the way, from her mother. A remark that had stuck. Dark men are goodness itself. Egan slept heavily beside her, and Helga lay observing him. Despite the late hour, she wasn't sleepy. His chin was relaxed, he had a beard, and he was snoring. This was how one might think about a stranger, not one's husband. Maybe he had been a stranger to her for quite some time. Ever since the day she had gone to him with such high expectations and departed with such deep disappointment, in her own quiet way, without acknowledging it as any great calamity. What does one person mean to another anyway, except when one forces the other to act? Helga's reaction was strange. The times that she'd stolen a small amount of the household money and hidden it in a little box, originally a jewelry box that she had been given for her confirmation, she hadn't had any particular purpose in mind. Perhaps she had tried to convince herself that it was for Christmas gifts or other things they would struggle to afford, but now she realized why she had saved this money. She smiled suddenly in the dark and very quietly slipped out of bed and walked to the drawer where she had hidden the box. The moon lit the little room like a false dawn. With the deftness of a thief, she counted the money. There were almost 40 kroner. She held them in her hands, smiling gently, redeemed and alone, like a child smiling in her sleep. All she could think of was an open, translucent umbrella with a certain shape and color. She longed for the morning, and her heart pounded fast, the way a woman's heart pounds when she's going to meet her lover. She imagined the street in the rain, and herself wandering beneath this silken canopy. Vague, bright thoughts spread like dandelion tufts across her mind. A house where she had worked, the wife in a dinner dress. Oh, Helga, bring me my umbrella. She had held many umbrellas in her hand without thinking about them. Things outside her world didn't really mean anything to her. Until now. Until she acted. She got back into bed, and her husband reached for her body in his sleep, mumbling something she couldn't make out. Carefully, she laid his limp hand back under the comforter as a distant tenderness flowed through her. For a second, she felt as much searing emotion as she could ever feel for another person, except for her mother. Recently, Egan had often yelled about getting a divorce, said that he wasn't going to be married to a broom handle. But words slung at her that way passed right through her as if she were a sieve. Her parents had always yelled like that when they fought. It didn't mean anything, and she was used to it. All that mattered to her was that the neighbors didn't hear. She was never one to argue.
She just figured that other people were like that and she wasn't. She defended herself in another way. There was no way of knowing when it would surface. Maybe Egan had never cheated on her at all, but that didn't matter anymore. The next morning, they both acted as if nothing had happened. That was how their lives were. Helga prepared her husband's lunch, made him coffee, and kissed him on the cheek as he left, exactly as usual. Then she went shopping, filled with light, expectant thoughts. And there was no one to tell her that she looked beautiful that morning, in the way that perfectly regular people can once in a while when they are feeling happy. She brightened the November day like a pale, delicate morning star, trembling gently and devotedly before it is extinguished. She wasn't the same person that she had been the day before. She was a woman walking into shops looking at umbrellas. It took a long time to find the right one, and she carried it awkwardly on the way home, like a man who isn't used to carrying a bouquet of flowers. Once she was inside, she opened the umbrella and skipped around the apartment with her. Her joy was pristine. She walked exactly like the woman in the yellow dress from her childhood. She walked past piles of dirty dishes, through large, well-lit rooms with palm trees in the corners and paintings on the walls. She entered an illuminated ballroom and remembered her first dance. She lifted the hem of her invisible dress and danced a few steps. The shaft of the umbrella was cool, thin, and strong. Something to hold tightly, something to admire, to believe in, to acknowledge. Now she could say to her girlfriends, "I bought an umbrella, and it would still be all hers." She closed it, studying the way it functioned, the shiny ribs, the tiny, adorable silk buttons, and the durable yet translucent cloth against which the rain would someday thrum its melody of forgotten and lost times. Her ecstasy lasted most of the day. She didn't think about her mother. She didn't clean. She didn't even dust the furniture. She didn't think about Egan, either. When he returned, unexpectedly, straight from work, she was sitting in the window at her usual spot with the darning basket, which was empty in front of her. She smiled at him and stood up. "I haven't made any dinner," she said offhandedly, adding as a provocation, which was unlike her, "I thought maybe you would be eating out." He didn't answer, and she ascertained that he was sober, and that he was trying to avoid her eyes. Why? She wanted to tell him about the umbrella and her little swindle. She needed to share her joy with someone. But he looked so terribly ceremonious as he sat himself at the table and cleared his throat. "I'm sorry about yesterday," he said awkwardly. "It wasn't true. I was just drunk." "I see," she said flatly. All day she hadn't given one thought to what had happened the day before. Even now it was strangely difficult for her to think about anything other than the umbrella. But the situation demanded that she say something. She felt embarrassed, as he did, and she stared down at her hands. "That's all right," she said truthfully. "I've forgotten all about it." She didn't notice the shadow darkening his face, and she didn't register how despairingly he tensed his whole body toward her. She was a person who didn't come when she was called. She was the one who called when she needed something in a thin voice which was easily drowned out by the storm. Besides, it is very rare that two people call at the same time and both get responses. She was content in herself. She had even had a bit extra to share. But her husband had pursued her for a long time like a big, clumsy animal, while she, agile and light as a scared gazelle, had run from him into a bright, hidden clearing in the woods. She sat down across from him, small and erect, and again seemed to him both secretive and alluring. As he had a long time ago, he asked jealously and fearfully, "What are you thinking about?" And just like back then, her clear, dreamy eyes glided over him as she responded, "An umbrella." And then with sudden animation, "I bought it, Egan. Do you want to see it? She was already skipping to the entryway, breathless with excitement. But he followed behind her and abruptly, angrily, pulled the fine object from her hands and broke it in half over his strong knee.
"There's your umbrella!"
he shouted, and she stood for a second in shock, staring at the pieces, at the cleverly formed ribs and the torn silk. Then she walked silently past him into the little living room, back to the manageable, the tolerable, the predetermined. She sat by the window as before, finally realizing that this was her place and that everything was the way it was supposed to be. The colors in her memory mixed together, forming the beginning of a kind of pattern. She realized that she could never be the owner of an umbrella. It was only natural. It made sense that the umbrella was ruined. She had set herself up against the secret law steering her inner world. Few people, even once in their lives, dare to make the inexpressible real. Helga smiled distantly at her husband. It was as if he had suddenly caused some string inside her to vibrate slightly, maybe because he had shown her the limits of her potential before it flowed out into nothingness. She didn't think about it like that. She just thought, this is exactly as if I had cheated on him, and he's forgiven me. And she nodded, seriously and absently, as if to a child who wanted to take a star down from the sky and give it away, when he, intensely occupied with screwing a new bulb into the ceiling fixture, said to her over his shoulder, "You'll get another umbrella." And now, the daily comment from the October 18th, 2021 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, Colin Powell's fateful moment. Though Powell created a doctrine of avoiding war unless absolutely necessary, he will be remembered for making the faulty case for invading Iraq, by Dexter Filkins. It's a terrible paradox in the life of Colin Powell, who died Monday, that the most important moment of his celebrated career came not when he led troops under fire in Vietnam, or when he orchestrated the successful expulsion of Iraqi invaders from Kuwait in 1991, or when he became the nation's first African-American National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. It came instead on the dais of the United Nations Security Council in 2003, when Powell, who was then Secretary of State, made the case for the invasion of Iraq, based on the conclusion that Saddam Hussein possessed nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons and thus had to be removed by force. The enduring image from that moment is Powell holding up a tiny vial of white powder, which stood for what was supposed to be Saddam's anthrax, and mortgaging his esteemed reputation and all the credibility of the U.S. government, telling the world that the U.S. had no choice but to go to war. My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources, Powell told the Security Council. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence. Of course, as the country discovered painfully over the next several months, the super weapons allegedly possessed by Saddam were no more real than a desert mirage, and the solid intelligence put forward by Powell that day turned out to be mostly conjecture and supposition, based on recycled reports from Iraqi defectors who had their own motives. The weapons of mass destruction turned out not to be there, but 165,000 American troops already were, and the catastrophic occupation of Iraq that followed brought to an ignominious end a singular moment of American global dominance and prestige, which Powell had done so much to bring about. The tragedy was personal, too. Powell was arguably America's most celebrated soldier, who, in surviving Vietnam and helping to rebuild America's shattered military, had appeared to learn its principal lesson, to avoid foreign occupations at all costs, and to go to war only when it was absolutely unavoidable. The Powell Doctrine, as it came to be known, held that the United States, when it must go to war, would do so only with overwhelming military force sufficient to destroy an enemy and bring about a quick end to hostilities. No more Vietnams. Powell summed up his military worldview at the beginning of the Gulf War in 1991, when he described what he was planning to do to Saddam's army in Kuwait. First, we're going to cut it off, and then we're going to kill it. And he did. It is a harsh irony of Powell's career that he cast in so much of his credibility on America's misbegotten return to Iraq a dozen years later. What happened that day at the UN? Powell did not talk about it much, but his friend and confidant, Lawrence Wilkerson, did. In an interview around the height of the Iraq War in 2006, Wilkerson, who had been Powell's chief of staff, told me that Powell had been deeply suspicious of the George W. Bush administration's efforts to push the country into war, and that when he was tapped to make the case for the invasion at the United Nations, he insisted on vetting the evidence himself. In the lead-up to the presentation in New York, Powell and Wilkerson huddled with the nation's top two intelligence officials at the CIA headquarters, the agency's director, George Tenet, and John McLaughlin, his deputy, to review the evidence that Saddam possessed weapons of mass destruction. The four men spent several days in Tenet's office, with Wilkerson, a former platoon commander in Vietnam, sleeping on the office couch. At the end of the session, Powell and Wilkerson came away sufficiently confident that the case for war was solid. We had three or four sources for every item that was substantive to its presentation, Wilkerson told me. What Powell later learned, Wilkerson said, was that the three or four independent sources for the intelligence often turned out, in many cases, to be only one. A source brought to the intelligence agencies of the United States or one of its allies by the Iraqi National Congress, the opposition organization headed by Ahmed Chalabi, an Iraqi exile who had gained the trust of senior officials in the Bush administration and had convinced them of the necessity of destroying Saddam's regime. Powell discovered that the story of one INC-sponsored defector, codenamed Curveball, had been made to appear as though it had come from multiple sources. As Wilkerson put it, a lot of these sources sort of tinged and merged back into a single source, and that inevitably that single source seems to be either recommended by, set up by, orchestrated by, introduced by, or whatever by somebody in the INC. Such an orchestration, it should be said, could only have reasonably been accomplished with the help of senior officials in the U.S. government, in the White House, intelligence agencies, and elsewhere. Wilkerson told me that he suspected that Tenet and McLaughlin had been warned off the shaky intelligence by German allies, but that they had used it anyway without warning Powell. We know, in fact, that Tenet was under enormous pressure from the White House, where President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney had seemingly already made up their minds about invading Iraq to come up with a solid case to publicly justify the decision. In other words, Powell was used. Bush, Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld, who was then the Secretary of Defense, cynically enlisted him and his enormous credibility to make the flimsy and ultimately faulty case for war. As Powell recounted to one of his aides, according to Robert Draper, the author of To Start a War, How the Bush Administration Took America into Iraq, Cheney had said to him, "You're the most popular man in America. Do something with that popularity." And so Powell did. Draper makes clear that Powell harbored doubts about the invasion of Iraq from the get-go. Powell might have resigned before the March 2003 invasion. If he had done that, he would have almost certainly have delayed the invasion or scuttled it entirely. But in the most fateful decision of his career, Powell chose to remain what he always aspired to be, the good soldier. And now from the Daily Shouts of the online edition, October 19, 2021 of the New Yorker magazine, Fight the Power, brought to you by the Power.
by Megahana Indurti. The world is more divided than ever. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, women are getting older. Yikes! That's why we at Avil Soda Company believe it's important to fight the powers that be, to dismantle the system, to think different, just like Martin Luther King Jr. did. In an ever-expanding global world, it's become increasingly vital for $1 trillion corporations like us to make more than a profit, to make more than a delicious soft beverage. It's time for brands like us to make a difference, a systemic difference. We're not one of these companies that just stands for regular old difference, like in 2009. In fact, we added systemic to our mission statement in 2013, before our factory in Laos was flagged for human rights violations, before we even had to. Pretty progressive. So how do we fight the power? With our new radical line of sodas. Sodas for the modern world. Sodas made possible by listening to the people. Sodas for activists and change makers like you. Introducing our green new cola. Now that's a big deal. It's our first ever soda to have less sugar and greener packaging. And we donate 1% of our profits to poor farmers in Laos. Okay? So Human Rights Watch, get off our backs. We also have a new Drink the Rich Cola, inspired by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You'll want to drink it in front of your rich parents and force them to look at their ugly rich faces in the reflected sides of our new plastic cans. Revenge never tasted so sweet. And finally, try our Fight the Power Cola that comes printed with the full text of Karl Marx's Das Kapital. Anti-establishment doesn't have to mean anti-delicious. Use code Solidarity, brother, for 15% off at the register. That's right, your individual consumption can make a difference. So keep consuming. Don't stop consuming. Do you want to stop making a difference? Do you want to stop fighting the powers that be? Gil Scott Heron once said, "The revolution will not go better with Coke." He was right. The revolution goes better with Avil Soda Company. Well, we ran out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.